Ask an American about their recent trip to a European city, and the common response is, "It was great. We walked everywhere." Americans might go to a European city for the art or the history, the food or the people, but chances are they'll also enjoy its pedestrian-friendly urban cores, efficient mass transit, and inviting public squares. And when they return home, they might wonder why we don't do that here where we live. Jeff Speck is an urban planner who has dedicated his career to determining what makes a city a place where people can thrive, and he's boiled it down to one key factor, walkability. In his book, Walkable City, he contends that not only can we turn more American cities into good places to walk, it's also essential. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Hey, Rick, it's my pleasure. It's a real honor to be on your show.
Well, thanks, Jeff. And I want to get right into this exciting topic because so many travelers wonder, come on, let's wake up. Let's learn from Europe and so on. And you mentioned in a recent poll, the most walkable cities were Boston, San Francisco, Barcelona, Amsterdam, Prague, Paris, and New York. When you think about those cities, Jeff, what do they have in common?
Well, you know, they may be better or worse tourist destinations. Most of them are great. But what they have is what I would call fabric. They have just the everyday shaping of space around streets, small blocks, small streets. And it's not so much the monuments, which are, you know, great to visit, but it's the space between the monuments, how well it's shaped, and whether it is organized really around the human body, as opposed to some other thing, like, for example, the automobile.
One thing that America has dealt with that European cities don't necessarily is those cities were built before there was cars, and our cities were built basically to accommodate cars. Isn't that kind of a fundamental challenge that we have in America, is that we have car-designed cities?
Yeah, so I grew up loving cars. I mean, I guess I still do love certain cars. And it took me a long time to realize that actually when it comes to city planning, which is my profession, cars are the problem. We design our cities around cars and they are no longer good cities to live in. The best American cities still have cars in them. I like to say that cars moving slowly are the lifeblood of the typical American city still. But it's that moving slowly that's really important. And of course, accepting cars in the proper measure. One thing we've learned, you know, after 50 years is that cars behave like water. They take the amount of space that you give to them. Mm. And actually, if you organize your city around cars, you end up with a car city. If you organize your city around people and places, you end up with a people and places city. And it's a choice we make as we design and grow our cities, whether we want to try to satisfy the automobile or become a place more where people want to be outside of the automobile. The kind of hidden secret of city planning that's a little counterintuitive is just that cars are not possible to satisfy, that the equilibrium that we experience in congestion is an equilibrium, and that as you widen streets or build more streets or build new highways in order to alleviate traffic, what you really do is just invite more traffic.
Somebody once reminded me, if you took all of the miles that you drive in a car, apart from big cross-country trips or something like that, but for getting around, and you divided it by how many hours you spent working to be in the car, to park the car, to pay for the car, to keep up the car, to fill the gas tank, you would not get that many miles per hour or per dollar.
You're actually quoting Ivan Illich, who is this multinational intellectual, I believe early in the 20th century, who talked about if you add up the amount of time it takes to pay for your car as well as to the amount of time that you're spending stuck in traffic, basically you're moving at pedestrian speed.
Yeah, and that's just something that we need to kind of think about. And what you make a point in your book, The Walkable City, is that transportation is actually becoming a growing percent of the income of people who rely on cars. I mean, every year, it's a bigger percent of how much money we have is invested in getting around, I suppose, because the cost of real estate is driving people away from where they work and where they shop. And like you said, if you rely on the car more, you're going to use the car more.
You know, it's the way our cities have been organized. So in the 70s, we spent 10 cents out of every dollar on transportation. Now, 20 cents out of every dollar we earn, we're spending on transportation. Poor people are spending as much on transportation as they are on housing. And some poor people are spending 40% of their income on transportation.
Wow.
You also have this condition in America that's kind of a newer development, which I call the suburbanization of poverty, where basically poor people now have been forced out into the suburbs. And you have the additional challenge, which is the suburban parts of our cities were designed around the presumption that everyone would be driving everywhere all the time. And these folks don't have cars. And that's why, shockingly, we have an 82% increase in pedestrian deaths over the last 14 years. People are living in places where they have to walk, but they aren't supposed to walk in those places.
Yeah.
And then, just to get a little more technical, the rise of the SUV in the U.S. has been a huge contributor to that number. In Europe, pedestrian deaths have been declining steadily. They have cell phones like we do, but they don't have the SUVs that we have or the street design standards that we have.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Jeff Speck, who's helping us explore how we might design our cities as better places for us to walk. Jeff is a city planner and the author of a book called Walkable City. Jeff's TED Talks and his YouTube videos have been viewed by millions of people. You can find out more about his work at jeffspeck.com. Jeff, reading through your book, I came upon ideas that never even occurred to me. Like you mentioned, the size of a block really shapes how walkable a place is. Smaller is more walkable, and bigger is less walkable.
There's no greater measure of a city's walkability than what we planners call intersection density. It's amazing to look at Rome, which has 10 times the intersections per square mile as the typical American city, and then look at sprawl, like a place like Irvine, California, right, or Scottsdale. And that has blocks that are 10 times as big as the typical American city. A wonderful comparison is Salt Lake City to Portland. And they were both built at the same time, but Portland, Oregon has 200-foot blocks and is delightfully walkable. Salt Lake City is tough to walk around. It's got 600-foot blocks. And actually, you always end up walking the same way from one thing to another. You never get to see very much, and there's only one path when you have these big blocks. Of course, another factor is the bigger the blocks are, the bigger the streets end up being. So the typical street in Portland is two lanes. The typical street in Salt Lake is six lanes. It really doesn't feel comfortable walking on.
So when I drive in different communities here in the United States, sometimes it seems to me that they've intentionally made the roads slower and narrower in urban neighborhoods with islands and roundabouts and more parking and tighter lanes. And I guess that's intentional, isn't it? That's an effort to what?
Yeah, that's a recent development in the U.S. They've been doing it in Europe since the 1970s. You know, in a typical year around 1970, 500 children were killed in traffic in the Netherlands. And mothers and other family members created this movement called Stop to Kindermord, right? Kindermord, death of children. And they got it down to like six kids a year. I mean, it was amazing what they accomplished. And what they realized was that actually street design determined the safety of streets, because there's no greater factor in the danger of a collision than the speed of the vehicle. And so what they do intentionally in Europe, this is going to sound a bit preposterous to your listeners because it seems like common sense, but it's common sense that we ignore in America. In Europe, the goal is to remove elbow room, to remove that forgiving lack of friction that causes people to speed. In the U.S., the engineering standards are all about forgiveness. They're all about designing for the drunk at midnight and trying to create a condition in which the fellow or gal will never crash their car. What that does, with the exceptions that you note, but in most American places, what that does is it creates speeds that are in the 30s or higher, as opposed to in the 20s. A car traveling 35 is seven times as likely to kill you as a car traveling 25.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
These factors are huge.
Another interesting issue is bikes and bike infrastructure. You can't just say, let's all bike. You have to invest in bike infrastructure. And a lot of times when I look at bike infrastructure, I think, well, that is a nice effort, but half as many cars can use this street now. But I guess that's not the reason they put the bike infrastructure in there.
You know, I'm not just a writer. I do a lot of actual plans for cities. And the biggest struggle, of course, is doing anything to reduce what we call the throughput of vehicles. And we're very careful, particularly in more conservative communities, to find ways to insert bikes that don't necessarily reduce the amount of road space for cars. Or I should say, we find those streets that have the extra room in them. But there's a point at which you have to acknowledge that whenever you make a change to a street that reduces the number of vehicles it can handle, people predict karma, what we call Carmageddon. You know, there's going to be gridlock.
Yeah,
no one's going to be able to get around.
Right.
What happens is people are smart and they adjust their behavior. And I've worked in a number of schemes where we've actually reduced the vehicular capacity of streets, and there's never been any traffic problem afterwards because people have adjusted And then all of a sudden you have a city in which it's better to bike in and better to walk in. This is what the most progressive American cities are starting to realize. Here in Boston under Mayor Wu, there's a decision that most other cities aren't making, that actually in places that are well transit served, that have bike facilities, that are walkable, there's no mandate to maintain the amount of traffic in a city, because car traffic is nowhere near as economically productive as foot traffic or bike traffic.
Boy, you know, Europe is my beat, and I've seen it evolve in the last generation, and it has been a very gradual but very, very definitive evolution from congested with cars and full of pollution and noise to now you've got more green spaces, you've got more bikes, you've got more pedestrians, you've got better transit, and you can hear the birds. And it's just, you know, somebody will say, and I'm inclined to say, oh boy, that's going to make drivers angry. And people who get it go, well, yeah, that's kind of the purpose.
Paris, Mayor Hidalgo, who you're probably familiar with, you're reminding me of her because during the lockdown for COVID, she had this quote where she said, we could breathe, we could hear the birds. If it could be like this always, how pleasant this could be. And she's made amazing investments before that and after that, 870 miles of new bike lanes, removing cars from the Rive Droite and the Rue de Rivoli, getting rid of tens of thousands of parking spaces. And this is stuff that has its opponents. And of course, if you propose this in the U.S., you get shown the door. But it is possible to make changes like this. And more cities around the world and even in the U.S. are heading in that direction without any of the predicted Carmageddon that we fear.
You know, every time I have the opportunity in my little town here north of Seattle, Edmonds, we have a fountain in the main intersection, Main Street and Fifth Avenue. It's now with cars going around it all the time. And then we have a charming old town, which is dominated by traffic and parking. And every time I think out loud, you know, we could make this a piazza where the fountain is, and we could have four blocks of pedestrian zone and then a periphery road, a road around the square. I've been doing this just like once a decade for 30 years, and my neighbors, I'm a pretty likable guy, and I've got
I was going to say, people like you, Rick.
I become a very unpopular person in the town. People say, well, if you like that so much, go back to Europe. People are really threatened by this traffic.
Well, you know, the solution in a lot of places is what we call tactical urbanism, which is to give it a try. Yeah. Like, just lay down some cones, throw some chairs in the middle of the street, some potted plants. Jeanette Sadek Khan, who was Bloomberg's transportation commissioner a number of years ago, that was the first step in transforming Times Square in New York. They didn't ask anyone's permission. They just came in overnight, and they tried it. And of course, there's a bit of mayhem for the first few hours, or maybe the first day, that you see how it works. You know, sometimes it won't work. There were a lot of streets pedestrianized in the U.S. in the 60s and 70s, about 200. All but about 20 of them failed. That doesn't mean we shouldn't pedestrianize streets. It means that we should test it out before we build it.
One of the items urban consultant Jeff Speck includes in his planner's pledge for making cities pedestrian-oriented is to create a framework in which walking is truly useful, safe, comfortable, and interesting. Jeff's book, Walkable City: How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time, is updated now in a 10th anniversary edition. You can see photos of projects Speck and Associates have designed for cities, nonprofits, and private developers from Tampa to Cedar Rapids at jeffspeck.com. Jeff, that I found interesting in Europe, especially I'm thinking the Netherlands, is, you know, there's more two-wheeled vehicles than four-wheeled vehicles on the streets of any Dutch town, and they rely on transit, but a transit, you know, a train ride or a bus ride or a tram ride, often starts and finishes with a bike ride. And you can bike to the train station, leave your bike there, take the train into town, and then pick up a bike and get to where you want to go. It needs to be kind of a general cohesive plan if you're going to commit yourself to bike travel. But once you do, it's just the people's choice.
Have you seen the parking garages they have for bikes in some of those cities? Thousands and thousands of bikes.
Yeah.
I was in Copenhagen on the Strøg, which is their mile-long pedestrian zone that's actually expanded beyond that street. I was trying to get some good pictures, but I couldn't get any good pictures because there were just piles of bikes everywhere that I was looking.
Yeah. But I was on that same street, and I looked around. I met a guy who was walking around with a plywood cutout the size of a car, wearing it on his shoulders. And he's walking down the street, taking as much space as a car as he walks to make this point. And he's reminding people that if everybody had a car, we wouldn't even fit on this street.
Well, you know, that's reminiscent of those six-foot hoops that we had people wearing during COVID, right, to demonstrate.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And someone commented that, you know, the automobile is the ultimate social distancing machine, in fact.
Really? When I saw that guy with that that cutout of a car, I looked around on the same street you're talking about in Copenhagen. I must have saw 100 bicycles, and they just melted into the environment to me. Had there been 100 cars there, it would have been the congestion that we're used to as the norm here in our country.
Well, I think it's just important to acknowledge, and, you know, we're both old enough to remember in the 70s, the Netherlands and other places in Northern Europe, they were as choking on cars as we were.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people say, oh, we're not the Netherlands. Well, in fact, the Netherlands were at one point not the Netherlands. You know, it was Holland, yeah. And it was full of cars.
All of those great squares that we enjoy today, they used to be packed with cars.
Yeah, in Italy as well. And many still are in Italy, in fact.
Oh, yeah. Another thing you bring up in your book, Jeff, is just the health issue. If you have a healthy walking society, people are just flat out in better shape. They live longer.
I say, you know, as a city planner, we've been arguing for more walkable cities for a long time, but we've had a, you know, difficulty convincing people. And I always say the best day to be a city planner was August 7th, 2004, when a book came out called Urban Sprawl and Public Health. And Here you had three epidemiologists telling us that the reason that we had the first generation of Americans who were expected to live shorter lives than their parents was because we had engineered out of existence the useful walk in our cities.
The useful walk.
Diet matters, but it's calories in and calories out, and we're no longer active because walking no longer serves a purpose for most of us. You know, we have to get in a plane and go to Europe to walk around when walking is actually useful or biking is useful.
In your book, you actually were talking about the useful walk. I like the phrase. It was a useful walk versus environmental-induced inactivity.
Yeah, that's a technical, you know, epidemiologist's phrase. But they're basically saying, you know, our environment is the cause of our obesity and other, of course, related illnesses.
We're out of time. I could talk forever about this, Jeff, but it's so fun to think that we have this opportunity to learn from Europe and make our cities more walkable. Jeff Speck is the author of Walkable City. And Jeff, if we could just cap this conversation with one point, I'd like you to tell us which American city you think gets it right in this regard and why.
Well, the cities that have made the most progress are near you in the Pacific Northwest. Lately, Portland and Seattle have done a ton. But I have to say that if you want to be technical about it, you know, New York City has more subway stops than all other cities put together in America, and that is why it is a city in which most people aren't driving. Most people are taking the train and then walking or biking. The most walkable places technically are the densest places and the places that have the best transit service. That's a whole separate point from the fact that I love to go and walk around the great southern cities of Charleston, Savannah, New Orleans. These places were, you know, as you said, like in Europe, built before the automobile. The automobile did not ream them out, and they're wonderful places to spend time. But, you know, almost every American city that's older than the modern era has neighborhoods like this, and you can visit them, and you can even live in them.
Jeff, my hunch is a generation from now, we'll look around and notice how hip we are in this regard, and we'll wonder what took us so long. Jeff Speck, the book is Walkable City. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, really, my pleasure, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Our website is managed by Andrew Wakeling. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.